Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 84 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the upper 70s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the low 90s. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy with a low in the upper 70s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's midnight.
The following program contains material some may find offensive. If you think you may be offended, we suggest you rejoin our programming in about an hour.
Recording Library of West Texas Radio presents My Favorite Murder with Karen Kilgariff and Georgia Hardstark. This popular true crime podcast presents the two hosts discussing their favorite tales of murder and hearing crime stories from friends and fans.
This is exactly right.
Hello there, I'm Bridger Weiniger. I have a new podcast called I Said No Gifts on Exactly Right. Every Thursday, I have a conversation with a friend, loved one, or somebody I'm secretly trying to ruin. I only have one request, no gifts. Unfortunately, every one of them deliberately disobeys me, meaning our conversation eventually turns to whatever object lies beneath the wrapping paper. Subscribe now on Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you like to listen.
We should do a podcast.
I mean, we've had like an hour of deep conversation before this podcast even started.
Yeah, we had to really connect and put some stuff on the table. It was important.
Air some dirty laundry.
I think every episode I'm going to terribly sing a bad song. That'll be my new thing. Do you mind?
No, because every episode you sing a good song. My notebook is so far away. I'm trying to read my notebook.
Georgia just stood up and it looked like she was starting to do stand-up comedy. We're both laying on the couch and then she jumped up and like took a pose.
I was like, can I make it to this dresser and get my notebook? Oops. Without. And then, yeah, it looked like stand-up comedy.
Oh, you're never going to. Because those are your notes from your watching your show with the famous lawyers.
Hey, let's get right into it.
Okay. I was trying to do a long introduction, but now I can't remember their names.
By the way, this is My Favorite Murder.
Oh, hi, yes. Hi, guys.
With Karen and Georgia.
Welcome to episode 14.
That's Karen. I'm Georgia.
Yeah.
Do you want to give a shout-out real quick before you even start to the name of that? Because we started naming the episodes weird things, and now we're just, like, on it.
Now we're just trying to make each other laugh. And when we think of it, it's just a pun contest.
The teens are hard.
The teens are pretty tough. And last week, 13 Going on Murdy is the episode title that my friend Owen Ellickson DM'd me on Twitter and basically just said, it was right after the number 12 dropped. He just DM'd and it said, next week should be 13 Going on Murdy.
And that's, you texted me that and I was like, yep.
There's no way it's not going to be.
Can we have a contest for like, so we don't have to think of them anymore? Like, people writing us.
Sure.
You like 14. What is 14?
What if we just open this whole podcast up and have other people do it?
What if all
every
of
every week?
It's all it's what are they called?
Moderated?
It's all moderated by other people.
It's moderated, produced, and talked through, researched, yep. And then yep. Performed by.
Yeah.
It'll be fun.
But it's by Karen in Georgia.
Yeah, we'll still own it. Mm-hmm. We'll own the copyright.
Speaking of, I just bought the rights to Michael Ramstad's adorable drawing.
Oh, yes.
Of My Favorite Murder. The one, if you see the drawing of the two of us lying It's a cute little cartoony drawing of us lying prone with, like, murder weapons around us.
That's the one on the Facebook page.
Yeah, Michael Ramstead, who's, like, this fucking incredible, like, incredible artist, drew it just for fun because he's a nice guy.
Thanks, Michael Ramstead.
And I was like, hey, can I buy that from you so we can make t-shirts? So in the next few weeks, hopefully.
Oh, yeah, because we've got some spec t-shirts, right?
Yeah, there's already a mock-up of the t-shirts. It's like, it's happening.
You guys, you can have a t-shirt.
Pretty soon.
We'll all wear t-shirts around town.
Yeah, and if we see you, we'll murder you.
Yep. That's how we'll know to murder each other. That'd be amazing.
What if that was the thing? Like, what
this whole thing turns into a crazed cult where everyone just murders each other.
What's that cosplay thing where you, like, there's people, like, you, if you're wearing a certain thing, you have to murder, you have to, like, tag that person, but it's pretend murder, and then you're out of the game. Have you heard of that?
Is it Dungeons and Dragons?
No. It's close,
though. Is it LARPing?
Yes!
Is it really?
Live action role playing! It's LARPing! How did you know that?
Is it the Renaissance Fair? I love nerds. I research their shit all the time. I want to know what they do on the weekends.
LARPing. What a grand idea. Live action role playing. Do you know that? That's so cool.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we're nerds too, and you did something on the weekend.
We're murder nerds.
Murder nerds.
I did do something. I went to see Strang and Buting.
The ticket of the weekend. Everyone was talking about this show.
Did I say that right?
I think so.
Okay, so they were the defense attorneys for Stephen Avery from Netflix, Making a Murderer, who, of course, if you saw it, you fell in love with them and are obsessed with them, as I am.
They're good men trying to do good in an unjust world.
Yeah. Defense attorneys as a whole, I think, are good people.
I hope so.
You know?
I mean, I wouldn't want to park next to them in a Trader Joe's parking lot. in general.
Right.
But that's an L.A. lawyer thing.
I like that they're defending his right to a fair trial. They're not being like, he's innocent. They're like, you're doing these things wrong.
You're doing everything wrong, yeah. State of Wisconsin.
Like, what I took away from this, and I was like, this might be stupid. I'm so sick of Making a Murderer. Like, I have read about it to death, like, other theories and shit. I was up on the show, like, hardcore. Like,
yes.
I was like, this, I don't want to fucking hear audience questions about the cat getting burned for fucking 2 hours, you know, in an uncomfortable chair. I spilled half a glass of wine on myself, like, right when I walked in.
Oh, good.
Because that's what
Red or white?
Oh, red, of course. Perfect. Why would I spill white wine on myself?
And you were wearing your white lace blouse?
Yeah. It was, and I started screaming. I was Carrie. It was great.
So you were trying to make it as difficult as possible from the outset?
Yep.
And then what happened?
It was excellent. If you have a chance to see it, everyone, go. Like, it was a real, if you're interested in true crime and law, fascinating. A couple things I wrote down. Guess how many, okay, so witnesses who are exonerated because they were wrongfully convicted. Guess what, out of 10, how many are overturned because of witness misidentification? So how many out of 10? I almost just said the number.
it's 11 out of 10. Well, 8? Is it some crazy high number?
It's 7, which is still a lot. I shouldn't ask people that, because it's like, it's like, if it's higher, then I'm like, oh, well.
Sorry. I always ruin our games like this by overshooting. And then it's sort of like, well, it is still pretty high, though.
Yeah, it is 7.
Yeah, that is high. Crazy high.
So 7 out of 10 overturned convictions are because of witness misidentification.
Yeah, they say eyewitness identification is one of the least reliable forms of what do you call it?
Of testimony?
Sure, or...
I feel like by the clues...
What's the word I'm looking for?
Evidence.
That's right.
There we go.
Ding, ding, ding.
We have a true crime podcast.
We should know these nouns.
I feel like by 2050, they're going to be like, how fucking antiquated was, like, 2010 and before that they fucking were relying on witness testimony?
Yes, for sure. Well, because at that point, there will be so much CCTV cameras, yes, in every corner of our lives.
That is a fair point.
That's probably what it'll be.
How do you feel about CCTV?
I like it.
I do, too.
I don't. It's fine. I mean, I understand why people have a problem with it. But the idea that you think, and maybe there'll be a dystopian future where we live in some terrible government state where they watch everything you do, and it's all, you know, 1984. But for right now, that's how you fucking find the guy that walks up and hits someone on the back of the head and puts them in their car before anyone knows what happens.
I feel like if you're a true crime fan, you agree with that. And I feel like if the laws are fair in general, then CCTV is okay. You know what I mean? If laws are like, you can't smoke cigarettes, and they're arresting people who are smoking cigarettes on CCTV, you know, like...
Yeah, that's bullshit.
Once the laws get a little fucking crazier, then... Which is like, you can't really tell, so...
Yeah. But I just... For now, anytime I watch a British procedural, I'm always like, well, they're going to get this on CCTV. Yeah. There's no problem. Yeah. Like, it's such a comfort to me in my old age.
The fact that they rely on, like, bank cameras, like, that you know, when you see those that are, like, the bank camera caught the street for 1 second and saw this car drive by, and that's how they knew this person wasn't where they said they were.
Yeah.
Like, if you're going to rely on that, and that's going to be admissible.
Throw a camera up there.
Fucking, listen, I want to be safe.
Who, I mean, are people, is it just not wanting to be monitored and not wanting to introduce the concept of a police state like that?
Yeah, but like,
it's already happening.
It's, I think, keeping citizens, and it's almost like, I feel like people will do less horrible things outside if they know they're being watched. I know, that's so naive. I think everyone in this whole conversation, whether they're for or against it, is being naive. Because if they don't think the government is already fucking following every single thing they say, they're stupid.
Right.
But if we think it's going to be okay that, closed captioning?
It's not
brought to you by...
I don't want deaf people to know what anyone is
absolutely
saying
on
Parenthood.
Speaking of, have you watched the new season of Happy Valley?
Yes, I have.
I had to put closed captioning on because it's so
When the sister talks, you don't know what she's saying.
It's a British procedural drama. You guys should watch. It's fucking great.
It's so good. I think people have talked about it on the Facebook page.
Yeah.
But yeah, because
I'm not done with the season yet, so don't tell me.
It's great. I won't tell you anything. But it is Northern England, I believe.
My lord, what are they fucking saying?
It's the craziest accent. And it's there's a lot of talk like this. Blah, 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 blah. It's that kind of, it's borderline Geordie. I think.
What's that?
It's a part Welsh or something like that. It's a crazy British accent.
Let me see if there's something else from that. I wrote a couple notes, but I hadn't red wine by then. 1 out of 5. Oh, what? So 7 out of 10 of the overturned convictions are from witness misidentification. 1 out of 5 overturned convictions come from jailhouse informants, which is like, yeah, dude.
Yeah.
If you're giving someone a fucking lenient, what's it called?
A sentencing?
Lenient sentence, because they're informing on someone. But you know what I do love is I love when they, like, plant a cop as a prisoner.
Yes.
And get that shit out.
Yeah. So then there's nobody benefiting that could possibly be lying.
Right.
It's a lock.
Right. And if you're stupid enough to tell your cellmate, which, like, so many people are stupid enough to tell their cellmate.
Well, they can't help it if they're that certain personality, the psychopath and the narcissist and all that. That's what I find so fascinating is that it really is not every single killer is like that, but there is that.
There's a certain
pattern.
Especially murders that make no sense. Like murders that aren't that aren't domestic abuse, that aren't, like, personal, these people are fucking crazy.
They're crazy.
When it's not out of, quote, passion, which I hate saying that word because killing your fucking spouse isn't passion.
No.
It's just pure evil.
It should be called hysteria. That's really what it is.
Yeah.
That is accurate. It's a man going hysterical.
I read a thing recently. There's a chopper. Do you ever think that when there's a helicopter over your house that it's like there's a loose criminal and they're going to parkour?
That's why I moved out of Silver Lake, because there was helicopters in my, like, the searchlight in my backyard every night. I was
so
like,
scary.
I can't handle it. It's dumb.
Crimes of passion and crimes of love. Like, you can't call it that. In the same way that someone I read recently that was like, you can't call, don't call it unconsensual sex. Because sex is sex,
right.
And rape is rape. And
use the word rape.
Right.
They so often
it's not
use
sex.
Yeah. They use euphemisms, like, in journalistically.
Yeah.
When it's like, when they're like, oh, they assaulted a child. You raped a child. Yeah. Say the words together so that people understand what happened.
Right. Molesting is like such a vague term.
Yeah.
I remember there was that documentary about that one priest who was like just sent from fucking church to church.
Oh, that documentary is one that I think about it all the time. Too. I wish I'd never watched it.
Well, there's one kid in it who's like he's, you can tell he's like became a drug addict, was so fucked up off it, and he says, that guy didn't molest me, he fucked me. Like, he says that. And yeah. It's like, yes.
That's right.
That's exactly, like, people don't talk about that. I'm so sorry for listeners who are listening with their children.
They're not. Well, there was one woman who said she was recommending it to her children, but I was assuming it was because they were all adults.
Right. One would hope.
One would fucking hope. Yeah, no, it's all of that. I feel like there's just waves of change because so many people have voices these days. And people get to talk about this enough so that it does affect change. But yeah, there's nothing that makes me angrier than it was like, accused of a sexual assault of a minor. Where it's like, why are you rewording child rape?
Yeah.
That's so strange.
Yeah.
They did it. They need to get called what they did. Have you seen any of that news about Dennis Hastert going to trial? He's that Republican, I think he was the Speaker of the House, and he's been molesting boys and raping boys, I just did it myself, for years. Well, he was a wrestling coach in Illinois. It's just a crazy story, but he was one of the lead people that tried to get Clinton impeached when he had that affair. And meanwhile, fully raping boys.
Somewhere in his head, that makes sense to him. It has to. Otherwise, how do you live your life? Like, I feel like if you and I killed someone, we would be... If you and I stole something from a grocery store, we would be, like, so... whatever, steal shit, I don't care. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
yes.
If I, like...
Well, we have consciences. These are people who, like, are sociopathic, or they're so... They just want what they want so that they rationalize everything that they do. That's the bullshit that these guys these old guys that have been in power for so long, they're used to it. And you see these other Republicans defending him by saying, there's one that said, I think it was Tom DeLay. Is that who it is? I don't know anything about politics, but he said, we all have personality flaws.
Oh, that is not a personality flaw.
It is not.
There's no excuse. I think it's become so normal in our culture that, like, there are molesters out there, and there are.
Yeah, but I feel like that more and more those, like, it just makes me think. Now we're going off on the craziest tangent, but it makes me think of, like, the Franklin Credit Union scandal, where for so long the people that tried to report that, they were like, you're out of your mind.
Yeah.
You're talking about government officials. Well, now these government officials, it's in the light of day. All of these rich, white, old men who have been telling everybody how to live and what their value is for years and years are fucking monsters of the highest order. It's crazy.
It's the people who are underrepresented and fucking striving just to make their families have a good life. You know what they say, that, like, that are the good people, is what I mean. Or sometimes they're not. Anyways, they say that, like, if you want to get into politics, there's a part of you that's a narcissist to begin with.
Yeah.
Like, you can't want to get into politics without having a little bit of fucking narcissism.
Sure.
Which makes sense to me. Like, I don't want to lead a bunch of fucking people.
And be a professional bullshitter. And be on the take.
And lie, basically just lie to people.
Yeah.
So you can get to where you want to get.
Yeah.
Into a place of power. Like, who wants to be in a place of power?
Well, and also what that power means, which it seems like the more we learn about it, it means that you go off to, like, Bohemian Grove and sacrifice a 6-year-old to a big wooden owl and shit, where you're just like, sorry, what?
That's a rep episode. If you guys want to hear more about this, what we're talking about, listen to the last podcast on the left episode.
Bohemian Grove.
And then, what was
the Franklin Credit Union. The way those guys did that and researched it is amazing. It's like episode. A 2 or 3-parter.
There's some shit that's hard to listen to. Like, they get into the shit.
They get into it, and there's a couple, because they also have one that's like Satanism in the government. Because they did a whole run about, like, all the satanic panic in the 80s and all that shit, and how these things that were once considered conspiracies are actually proving to be 100% true.
Well, it just sounds so ridiculous and obvious. It sounds like we're Jelly Biafra being like, no, the government is bad.
Yeah.
And like, the government is Jerry Brown. You know, it's like, how was that?
That was like dead
one,
on.
1% of our listeners were like, yes,
she nailed that.
The other ones don't know what the fuck I'm talking about.
So good.
Yeah.
Wait, anything else from the... Was it the Ace Hotel you say?
Yeah. It was...
Right there.
Well, it wasn't. They have this, like, feet up. Where are you pointing? Oh. They have this, like, gorgeous theater at the Ace Hotel that they, like, fucking... They stole. It was, like, a gorgeous theater to begin with, and Ace Hotel was like... This is what I wrote, because I love my little, like, crazy notes. False evidence, the most dangerous tool the cops use, said Strang.
Yes.
False evidence is the most dangerous. He was, these dudes were like.
Is he the smaller one? Dean Strang?
Strang is the smaller one. The other one looks like the eagle from The Muppets.
Yes. Sam the Eagle. And Dean Strang is like this sensitive poetry teacher that's just trying to catch a break and can't believe.
He's like, I'm just trying to teach you kids about poetry and you won't listen.
Yep.
And like, I mean, these guys can't make a ton of money, and I mean, they're just justice fighters. Like, they're so admirable that they are, you know, like the things they were saying about how they used to not allow voice recordings in a fucking interrogation.
Oh, wow.
Which is like, it's common fucking sense that you would, if you were a cop, you would want this to be recorded, at least audio, if not video. My cat is just smelling everything about you right now.
I love it.
Because you're not doing anything wrong. And so you should... It's the same thing with the fucking closed captioning.
Yes, that's right. But I mean, I was going to say, you know, it immediately made me think of, like, LA Confidential, where it's like, you can't record it if you're not doing it on the books, and if... Cops are, you know, there's always that mentality of, by any means necessary, you gotta get this perp. But that leaves out, you could be wrong. And that's the problem that people, I think, that get into power like that, they lose the ability to question their own judgment.
Right.
They lose the ability to be wrong.
Right. They're just like after what they think is, quote unquote, the truth.
And it has to be their truth,
right,
because they have to win.
Well, that's false confessions. And they talked about Brendan Dassey, the nephew in Making a Murderer, who got, you know, who confessed. And, like, half of his testimony isn't video. You know, half of the shit that happened between them. And there's no parent there, and there's no lawyer there. That shit should have all been stricken from the record. Like, that should not have been entered into anyone's... What is the word?
Entered into...
Evidence?
Evidence? Did we miss the word evidence two times in the true crime podcast?
Wow.
Guys, episode 14 is a real roller coaster.
14, we don't got it.
14, the bell tolls. Nope.
Dude,
stop
yes.
Stop it. Don't do that.
Yes.
Do not condescend to me.
14, the bell tolls.
No.
Okay, write on our Facebook page or tweet at us what number 15 should be. Please.
Yeah.
Please.
But know that, but you're now in the realm of comedy writing, and so you might get your feelings hurt. Just know that.
We will insult. We're gonna read the worst ones and go with the best one.
And we're going to name first, last, and middle names. Oh, it's going to be a bloodbath.
We will not do any of that.
Can you imagine? We just turn. We never even make it to episode 20 because we turn on everyone and ourselves.
What if we just become huge bitches?
What if we turn this podcast into a podcast called What If? And we just keep... It's just a shit ton of conjecture for an hour and 10 minutes.
Like, what if? But we had to say it like that. Like, what if?
No, what if?
Like, no. You don't even know.
You don't... What if? Just keep going higher.
Yeah. Let's do that.
All right. Should we do our... Did we do all of our house cleaning? Do we have any corrections?
I feel like...
For our corrections department.
A murder enema. Like, I just feel good right now. I got a true crime enema.
That's good.
I know.
That'll clean you right out.
I mean, that just... Whoosh. You know what I'm saying?
Wow. Do you want me to go first this year?
This year. So this theme is, so last week we did 1980s murders, which was like easy for both of us, I feel like.
Yeah.
And then we were like, we're going to do 1990s murders. And then I feel like both of us today were like, what the, I can't find a 90s murderer.
I was like, I can't find one. I don't have the will to live. What did I do to my eyebrow? I've had a lot of eyebrow problems this weekend. I did something to my right eyebrow. I mean, it's not filled in right now, so you can see it. I just did some bottom plucking. You know how sensitive I am about eyebrows.
It's got an arch. It's got a nice arch.
This over here is okay.
It looks like you're being like inquisitive.
All the time. I constantly want to know something that I won't ask.
I tried to furrow my brow today to be like, oh, I understand to someone. And they're like, are you mad at me? Because I have Botox. So I can't furrow my brow correctly. And I was like, maybe I need to lay off the Botox.
Are you mad at me?
I was like, no. This is concerning. You just can't tell because I have fucking, what are they called? I have just like chemical
botulism in your muscles.
Botulism in my forehead.
You know what, LA,
like 25,
and you do, girl. You're wrinkle free.
Because I can't live another day with wrinkles. No, I don't care.
Well, you're on that TV. I tell you, there's nothing worse. There's nothing worse than seeing what your face does on
HG. Oh, what is it called?
HD.
HGTV. Oh man. Take a look at your face on HGTV.
Tiny House Hunter's wrinkles, the worst kind.
We were drinking and watching, like, you live in what? Like, it's something like, and yeah. I was screaming at the TV, as I do when I drink and watch TV and smoke, about how everyone has a trust fund and go fuck yourself. Like, yes. I was angry at these people.
Why? Because they were
stupid fucking, that's what you think about as your fucking four, like, they're...
What do they live in?
We turned this fucking TV into like a 6-story open concept. Fuck you.
Living, I wish I was here for that.
Just screaming.
Yeah. Well, I think they intentionally cast kind of awful people so that you hate watch it. Because if you like the people, then you're just watching people buy shit and or like consider buying shit.
Yeah, but I live with someone, and so them having to hear me scream at the TV about fucking about the only way you could live like this is with a trust fund.
Yeah,
they like you need to mention that up top.
Well, also to watch people buying like second homes on the beach. Yeah. There's those ones that are like beachcombers or whatever. Yeah. Where I'm like, pardon me, I drove by, you know, 6 homeless people literally laying on the sidewalk on my way over here. Yeah. And these motherfuckers are buying a fun second home.
There's only so much everyone needs. Like, you need a basic maximum of shit. And the rest of it is you being an asshole.
You're not going to be any happier in the Bahamas.
No.
It won't work.
You know why? I'm going to go to your fucking estate sale. And you're going to be in a home and I'm going to buy your shit. Oh my God, this is getting deep.
This is going exactly where I need it to be. Finally, we're taking down the real monsters of this world, the people on HGTV.
I mean, I'm happy for them.
No, you know what? Lots of love going out to them.
Here's what we always say.
Do Lizzie's.
Wishing them well. Oh, Lizzie is. You got to come from a place of love. Lizzie Cooperman. Love her.
Lizzie Cooperman, legendary comedian.
She's fucking amazing.
Good friend.
You want to go first or me go first?
I'll totally go first.
Please go first.
First of all, somebody tweeted this on the Twitter page at MyFaveMurder, if you'd love to join us over there. I think I got locked out somehow on my phone and I can't figure out how to get back.
Keep doing that.
I do it and then I don't try to fix it. That's my thing.
You try twice and you're like, fuck this.
And I'm like, no, you know what? Fuck it. But somebody did tweet this, and it made me realize, because someone said something about Murderpedia. Mm-hmm. I think they were just mentioning it, but they could have been saying, I'm on to you, how you use that in all your research, which I don't think they were, but they could have been, because I absolutely do. And Murderpedia, just as a recommendation, if you ever want to know about a killer, it's this amazing website where they have compiled tons of articles in one spot. So you can read, like, local newspaper articles about the person that you are researching, and
there are links to every article. Can you tell I'm furrowing my brow in anger right now? You cannot.
I can't. But I also don't have my glasses. glasses on.
Okay.
And I'm wearing a French sleeve t-shirt, so I'm slightly uncomfortable because I have an intense farmer's tan. There's so much going on in this apartment. We should get someone to paint it.
This, Allie says this apartment is like a YouTube channel, and so it's really hard to pay attention to anything in here because there's just like cats and like cute vintage things.
It's
like,
so true. It's kind of aqua.
It's very aqua. It's like if you had a seizure issue. Well, you do. Oh, shit.
No, it's fine.
If you were Karen.
I haven't in years. And I wouldn't in here. It's pleasing.
Okay, good. I'm glad.
So anyway, I get all my research off Murderpedia. Probably should have said that. Probably should cite research, but, you know, whatever.
We're say Reddit a lot.
Credit here, credit there. So here's what I looked up. I literally looked up MySpace murder just to see if there ever was one. And there was, but it didn't happen in the 90s. Somebody actually committed a MySpace murder in 2003, where I was like, you're dated. A day late and a dollar short, Mr. MySpace, hanging on to MySpace way longer than necessary. I also, because somebody suggested on the Facebook page, looked into the Swedish black metal murders of Norway. Sorry, not... somewhere in Sweden. And I thought, that'd be kind of funny and interesting and whatever. Yeah. It's so dark.
Yeah.
It's just a culture of people who are all trying to out,
right,
like, crazy each other.
Like, they don't want to support those people.
Here's the one thing I will say about it that I do support. Part of the reason they started burning churches, because they have some amazing, really, really old churches, but they were burning them because they had a kind of like a really oppressive Christian culture in those countries that really fucked up a lot of people.
Yeah.
And so that I support, but.
But did they think it through in that way? Like, this is what the message we're sending. No, it was probably just a bunch of fucking 20-year-olds.
It's hard to say because the stories I read around, like, there was church arson, but then it went into, like, stories that I don't even want to repeat because they're just, it's just dark for darkness' sake. Yeah. And then they, like, record it or they record, you know, it's crazy shit that it's just like, I don't enjoy any of that because it's like.
We want the intricacies of fucked up things that have happened in the past. We don't really want to, like, highlight people doing things to get attention.
That's a real fuck you dad feel to all of their crimes. So I was like, eh.
Yeah. We did that to ourselves. We don't need to fucking talk about it with other people.
Exactly. Also, there's like tons of really good books about it and you can go down into that. But that's also the part of it. I'm not interested in the gore.
Yeah.
Like the story. I like learning about the psychology. Gore is just, you know, whatever. I like acoustic folk rock music.
Murders.
And I'm listening.
I like when someone from Beechwood Sparks murdered someone.
Have you ever heard of the Austin City Limits murders? They're insane. All right. So here's what I landed on.
Okay.
And this, I think this guy has it all because I was trying to look for something that would spark a memory where I'd be like, oh, I do remember that and I liked it. So I was looking at San Francisco murderers or San Francisco serial killers. Oh, well, of course the Zodiac is all over that shit and you can't get past it. Night Stalker a little bit too. Richard Ramirez was up there for a while. But then I stumbled upon a killer named Joseph Nasso. And so this story has a little of all the things that we like, and it pulls in a murder we've already talked about that he might be responsible for.
Oh, shit.
There's a lot going on. But here's what happened. When this guy was 76 years old, his probation officers did a random visit at his house in Reno. And because he was like, it was some weapons violation or whatever. And so they got to search the whole house because he had weapons and ammo. And they found hundreds, if not thousands, of photographs of nude women who were posed in very unnatural positions, who appeared dead or unconscious, with mannequin parts and lingerie strewn about in every picture. So the cops, like, find this stash, and then they're like, holy shit, we gotta really search this house. And they end up finding newspaper clippings, the identification of women, like identification that he shouldn't have. Like, clearly it's starting to look like serial killer.
What do we call them?
Evidence. No?
I'm just going to keep whenever we forget something.
So serial killer, when they get a pride, when they get a thing.
And
they,
what? Yeah, that's...
What is the prize?
Oh my God, why? Why is this happening?
What is it called when they walk
Not a token.
Token!
Is it a token?
It's a token. Let's call it a token.
Everyone knows
when, like,
the
they take an earring or they take
it's which their
is so
little...
stupid. That's how you get found out, bro.
Exactly, but also, and he also did it the best way of getting found out. He kept a rape diary.
Abso-fucking-tively don't do that.
Well, here, we're glad he did, though, because he'd been doing it since the 50s.
Holy shit.
And he had these, it was every little interaction he would have with a woman, he would write down, and it leading up into these rapes, where and his bizarre and strangely casual phrasing of, like, picked up a hot redhead, she really fought me, a lot of that kind of shit.
Oh,
yeah.
God.
So... they go through the years, they're going through, then they find, they stumble on this list of 10 women, names and locations. And they start to put together these names and descriptions of these women and locations are starting to match up to missing women in these same towns.
Can I say that's my dream? Like, I'm in the wrong, that's my dream job?
Is what? Matching that shit up?
Is being a detective to find those things?
Yeah.
I'm in the wrong fucking profession. Go on.
You mean eating dessert on TV isn't... isn't giving you the same feeling?
Shockingly, I don't feel fulfilled and that I'm contributing to society.
What if you were a detective, but you still, you had to get even more Botox? For some reason, you felt the pressure in your...
Because I was giving too much away to what do they call it, to criminals when I'm, like, in the room with them, and I'm like, no way! Like, no, you have to get Botox, so stop.
Fill your whole face.
Yeah. Stop throwing your brow
and ease up all your muscles.
Criminals.
So, basically, they start lining these things up. This guy has been raping and murdering and dumping women's bodies since the 70s.
So they were like, these are real.
These are real. And they basically end up, whatever the, within the same country version of extraditing is, they move them, they take them from Nevada into California because some of these murders happened, around San Francisco, basically. And what they come to find out is that, he referred to his that rape journal as his dream diary detailing his fantasies. And he said that he used the word rape, loosely, quote, like how guys talk. So what they start to realize is he's lived in close proximity, like in the same city as where these women have all been taken from and dumped. He is, wherever it's happening, he's lived in the same place.
I love when they make those connections. It's like a puzzle piece, and it takes a shit ton of legwork of, like, interviewing people, and
yeah, it's
fascinating.
It's so, and it must be so fucking satisfying.
Ugh.
Yeah. So it turns out, the other thing that's detail that's taking place as all of these facts and evidence unfurls is that the women have double initials, same first and last name.
We talked about this.
Initials, which is the same as the alphabet murder. So these are the women that we're talking about here. It's in 80s and 90s, but in the 70s. There were a series of child murders called the Alphabet Murders in Rochester, New York.
I remember talking about
it. Or around there, yeah. You talked about it. So it was little girls between the ages of 10 and 12, and they all had the same first and last initial, which I have too.
Karen!
I would be totally have been at risk. So Carmen Colon, age 10, was found in November 18th, 1971 in Riga, New York. Wanda Walkowitz was 11. She was found April 3rd in Webster, New York. And Michelle Manza was 11, and she was found November 28th, 1973 in Macedon, New York.
And did they find that he was living there then?
They found out that he is a New York State native, and that he was visiting the area in, he was visiting relatives in that area at the same time. But they say that the two cases are not connected because these in the 70s, these little girls were prepubescent, and these other women are older and probably prostitutes.
Yeah, he only wanted to murder, he wanted to murder women of a certain age, not, what the fuck?
Yeah,
it doesn't. And it's like, when you murder a child, people get more outraged about it, so he stopped doing that because people, because it was, like, more obvious.
People were all over that shit.
Right, so there's like, well, why don't I murder, I can't murder children anymore because it gets too suspicious.
Also, he's old at this point. Yeah. So like, he was arrested when he was 77. These murders happened when he was in his mid to late 50s. So, and also, he probably can't get around little kids as much, but you sure can hire a prostitute anytime you want. Like, it's, there's a logic problem that I have with it that's so irritating because there's, and there, the other thing was there was DNA found on the last little girl, Wanda.
How is there no DNA on the other ones? It seems impossible.
Well, he's proven to have killed these four women that were on his list.
Mm-hmm.
And his DNA is on them. But they did find, they don't have any DNA on these little girls in the, from the 70s, for the Alphabet murders, except for one on Wanda, and his DNA doesn't match what was found on her. Except for, my thing is, test it again.
Yeah.
Do something, look further into it.
It seems impossible to me that before there was DNA testing, that, like, every single murder, like, before people thought about leaving DNA, aside from fingerprints, that there has to be a DNA on every crime scene. You know what I mean? Like,
yes.
And it was just handled wrong, or wasn't taken, or it was lost, or it was destroyed, and or it's too old.
Yeah.
You know, like, before we thought about these things.
It's just amazing that that was recently, actually.
Yeah.
Like, DNA is as new as the OJ trial.
Totally.
It's crazy to think about that.
Totally.
But they did save some things, but it's like, yeah, if this, if her body was found on in 1973, then maybe you're going to have some problems with that DNA, but, like, that everything else, the cops are saying, yeah, there's those other things are just a coincidence. Well, is it a coincidence that one of his victims in 1978 was also named Carmen Colon?
Are you kidding me?
The same exact name as the first victim in the Rochester ones? Same exact name.
I wonder if sometimes psychological profiles that we make, that psychologists and detectives make, are these, like, this is what the person is like, this is what they're into, this is what they're after, this is how they are, are, like, detrimental because it makes them, it makes them narrow-sighted.
What's
the word?
Like, nearsighted or farsighted. Flawed in their sight.
Right.
Problematic.
Evidence.
With seeing evidence.
Yeah, because...
Totally.
That, how could that...
These are so many coincidences. They have now written off four coincidences.
You can't write that shit off.
It's crazy. So... The bodies that of the grown women, which this was only 7 years later. So the last little girl, or less, because the last little girl, Michelle, in Rochester was found in 1973. Well, in 1977, Roxanne Rogash was found in Fairfax, California, which is like 15 minutes away from Petaluma, from where
dude,
I grew up.
You guys have all the murders.
We have tons of NorCal, baby. But this girl was only 18.
Yeah, that's not an adult.
It's, I mean, and also they were saying she, they assumed she was a prostitute, but there was no proof of it. Her parents said she was not.
Yeah.
And so it's just a weird police theory. This is a perfect link. This is only 5 years later, and this girl is, like, basically his bridge into older women. It's
the
just.
And the word prostitute, it's so, like, definitive that this person has been selling their puss on the fucking sidewalk. Like, that's what that means, you know? Like, that's what you picture.
Yes.
Instead of, like, oh, maybe she was on drugs and, like, dating a lot of people, but, like...
Maybe she was wearing hot pants because it was fucking 1977.
Right, but that doesn't make her a, quote, sex worker.
It's a human being that got killed.
Yeah.
I mean... And yeah, and it's that thing of, it makes very clear of, like, the problematic parts of the word prostitute, because it immediately makes you go, doesn't matter, doesn't count,
doesn't matter. She lived a high,
high-risk lifestyle.
High-risk lifestyle. So that's what she gets.
Right. Well, so, okay, so this girl was, Roxanne was 18, and she was dumped by the side of the road, strangled and nude on January 10th, 1977. Carmen Colon, the second one, the older one in California, was found August 13th, 1978 on the Carquinez Highway, and she was 22. She was 30 miles away from the first victim, so it was clearly he's in that area. Then in 1981, the body of Shirley Patton, who doesn't have the same initials, but she was also 56, and she washed ashore near the Naval Depot in Tiburon. And Nasso managed the place she used to live. And he also had a photo of her. And he was considered a prime suspect, but then gave investigators elusive answers and was never charged anytime in the next 30 years.
Duh, bro. Like, to speak in fucking NorCal terms. Duh, bro.
Duh. And then a woman named Pamela Parsons in 1993 was found in Yuba County. She was 38, and she also lived near him. And then a woman named Tracy Tafoya was found dead in 1994 in Yuba County. She was drugged, raped, strangled, and her body was left near a cemetery. So this guy had pictures. He had descriptions of them, like all the shit. It was just like a lock. He represented himself in court. Of course.
Like, that means I'm sorry, but that means you're fucking guilty as shit.
It means you're guilty and it means you're crazy. And so, of course, he was convicted of all four murders in 2013.
Yeah, dude.
He's in jail. He's, I think he's, what do you call it, up for the death penalty, but I couldn't find whether or not he's gotten it yet. But that woman, when he was being tried, the woman who he raped, one of the early rapes that was in Berkeley, she was waiting at a bus stop and he picked her up and raped her. And when she went to the police, and she said this in court, which is, I just couldn't get out of my mind. When she went to the police to report it, they said, they told her that they thought she was just trying to make her boyfriend jealous by making up this story.
Can't even. I
so
can't
that's
even.
What we're coming from. That was 50, almost 60 years ago.
Yeah.
And this is where we are now. I mean, like, that's the kind of thing where, like, we're coming from a dead stop of cops not even listening when people are, like, repeated rapes in this entire area.
Yeah.
There's a reason people have gotten this old piece of shit has been getting away with murdering women for years and years.
What gets me in every case of serial murders or multiple murders or, you know, even... I don't want to say that you have to be murdered to be important, like rapists, you know, because that is devastating to your entire life, is the people that are subsequent to them, to the rapists and murderers getting paroled early. The people after this person should have been caught or was caught, that's on the state.
Mm-hmm.
And that's on the judge and that, you know, like,
you mean like the victims afterwards?
Yeah. Like those are the people that like fuck me up. Is it like that should have been fucking stopped? And the family of the victims that it happened to beforehand, they must feel guilty that, you know, this person didn't stay in jail or this person was never caught, even though they were like, here's all this evidence. Like,
it's nightmarish. It's just ridiculous. It's because when it's so cut and dry, like this man had all the evidence in his home.
Yeah.
He's going to jail for the rest of his, you know, very short life, hopefully. But like that, it went on for years. If those parole officers hadn't done that search, nobody would have ever known.
It's the same thing about like child abuse cases where the child protection agency is like, nope, they're fine, and like close a case.
Ugh.
And then the kid dies, and it's like, this is on you, and there's nothing you can say that gets you out of this. Like, I don't care if your boss was this way. I don't care if you had a huge caseload. Like,
well, the problem is they don't. That kind of shit, people, human life is undervalued.
Right.
So they don't pay people who are supposed to be protecting those voiceless people enough. And they have too many, even though you're right.
No, I'm wrong. There's no excuse.
But it's just like, but we have to start putting money to the things that are important, services for people who need help, as opposed to just fucking like, everything just goes to the one person. Oh, we can't get into this shit. This is just crazy.
I feel like I'm going to get in trouble for saying that. And I think that social workers are trying so hard and they're working against a bureaucracy that is undervaluing them, and I'm sorry.
I think probably the point is that it's this system is to blame.
Yeah.
The system that's supporting, that one person having 30 caseloads.
Yeah.
It doesn't even make sense.
No, you're right. I feel like I want to edit that out because I feel like a dick for saying that. And teachers should be paid more.
I mean, you know, let's get rid of it. That's our friend Joseph Nasso, the great Jesus. NorCal, and possibly, I'm going to say it like a detective. I like him for those alphabet murders in the 70s.
Oh, and yeah, I get it. Like, you like him? Oh.
I like him for it, like, cop style.
I agree.
I thought you'd like that, too, because we've talked about that.
No, I do. I like it. I like you for liking that.
What's yours?
Okay. So.
Because you're a 90s kid, right?
Yeah. And this one happened when I was 16. In May of 97, right before I turned 17. And so this thing that happened, the person who did it was someone that, like, I would have dated. And I remember it happening. He was from Southern California, the person who did it. And the girl was from Orange, the girl he killed was from Orange County. And it was such a, like, I would have hung out with this guy, you know, like this guy would have been my friend. And it made me realize that the people you think are cool because they're one of you, you don't know who they are at all.
Mm-hmm.
I'll get into it. But so May 25th, 1997, Jeremy Strohmeyer, who was 18, and David Cash, his friend, who was 17, they were at the Prima Donna Resort and Casino in Prim, Nevada, which we've all been to. It's the casino with the giant roller coaster right before you drive into Vegas.
Yes.
It's fucking cool because it's like going into a Denny's from the 80s.
With a roller coaster that goes through the restaurant.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's just like, it's like Knott's Berry Farm. It's just like quaint and it doesn't mean to be, you know? So they're there. They're from Long Beach. At 4 a.m., Strohmeyer begins to make, quote, playful contact with 7-year-old Charisse Iverson, ooh, who was roaming the casino alone, which is something that I did. Like, my dad took us to Vegas on regular occasion, not really, but he took us a few times, and was like, go play in the arcade. And you just fucking walked away.
But he didn't do that at 4 a.m.
No, not at 4 a.m.
4 a.m. is...
Yeah.
Not well, right.
So the dad was gambling and drinking. They told him to keep a closer eye on his daughter, and he ignored them and told his son to go watch the kid, which is like, my parents were divorced. If, like, I had gotten lost, my mom would have killed my dad. Like,
yeah.
I get it. And, like, it was from the killer being my age to the kid being... You know,
in that situation.
In that situation is, like, understandable. So Strohmeyer, who's being playful with Charisse, he leads her into the women's restroom. And while in the restroom, they begin having a playful wet paper towel fight, like, jokingly. Like, he's playing with this 18-year-old guy is playing with the 7-year-old girl. Like, they're buddies, you know? And, like, when you're a little kid, you, like, want to make friends with the older kids. And then... he leads her into a bathroom, and then this is really troubling to me, is that the friend, last name is Cash, he walks into the restroom to look for his friend, Strohmeyer, and he peered over from a neighboring stall and saw Strohmeyer restraining the girl and threatening to kill her if she didn't stay quiet. Cash told the police that he tried to get Strohmeyer's attention by calling his name and tapping him on the head, And Strohmeyer stared at him blankly. So do you know what Cash did?
He
walked away. He left. Which is so troubling to me.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's more troubling than this murderous fucking kid whose dad was in prison and whose mother was a schizophrenic. The fact that this fucking guy walked away. He ends up, he molests and kills her. I don't want to say in the way because it's like, it's so troubling. They find out who he is by putting surveillance video up, and people from his high school in Long Beach are like, that's this dude. The cops surveillance his house and identify him. He runs away and he ingests a bunch of drugs and writes a suicide note, pretty much confessing to it. Like, there's no question during any of this in the trial that he did this. There's no, like, maybe he didn't do it. Like, he clearly did this. So let's see. So his defense attorney, who represented the Menendez brothers.
Yeah.
Weird.
The woman?
Yeah. Leslie Abramson.
Yeah.
So Strohmeyer claimed he was high on alcohol and drugs at the time. He didn't remember committing it. But apparently he hoarded pornography, including pornographic images of children, and admitted fantasizing about sex with young girls. And in a chat room, which, God, remember those? He wrote, I fantasize about having sex with 5- and 6-year-old girls all the time. They couldn't prove the message came for him, but right before the trial, hours before it was going to start, he entered a plea on his behalf. So his plea, that he was guilty to 4 charges. First-degree murder, first-degree kidnapping, sexual assault on a minor with substantial bodily harm, and sexual assault on a minor. That's your plea. Like, if first-degree murder and kidnapping and is your plea, you are a fucked up individual. You know? Like,
yeah.
Manslaughter isn't what you go for.
Right.
Like, you go for fucking first-degree, and you plead guilty to it. So he was sentenced to 4 life terms, one for each of the crime he pleaded guilty to be served consecutively. So this motherfucker's never getting out.
Do you think that he did that just to get it over with? Like, he knows he's guilty. He's just, basically he's coming in saying, this is all the shit I did. Let's just get this over with.
I think it was a death penalty. It was a death penalty case, and he had confessed to it. There was, like, the confession was admissible in court. It was a death penalty case. I think he knows he would have gotten death for this.
Oh.
So this is his way of staying alive.
Okay.
So the post-trial shit's really interesting to me, too. So Jeremy Strohmeyer is just appealing the shit out of it. It really bothers me that this guy is so clearly guilty. There's no conspiracy. There's no fucking question.
His friend saw it.
His shitty friend saw it.
Yeah.
There's fucking surveillance tapes, but he keeps appealing it instead of fucking, this is what I don't understand about sociopaths, like, just admit your guilt. Like,
no, they can't.
Let the family heal from this.
They don't care about the family. They don't care about anybody.
Don't make them testify every 4 years.
They don't care about those people.
But
they can't lose. They can't. It's about getting anything you want all the time. It's the sociopathic mind is so fascinating because they don't, there is no mercy and there is no logic beyond how do I get what I want.
There's no fault.
No.
Well, what's interesting is that the fucking David Cash, so Charisse Iverson's mother demanded that Cash, the friend, be charged as an accessory, which, like,
good.
Fucking clearly, no. Authorities stated there was not enough evidence connecting him to the actual crime. So he never got prosecuted. And I remember, like, frequent news updates of, like, him going to Berkeley and his fellow students being like, get this fucking kid out of here.
Wow. He got into Berkeley?
Yeah. Fuck.
So this wasn't some dipshit.
No, these were like hacky sack college kids. Both of them. These were like skater college kids.
Fuck.
that, like, we would have been, like flirting with. You know what I mean? Like, so, but here's what Cash says in the weeks following Strohmeyer's arrest. He says, quote, "I'm not going to get upset over someone else's life. I just worry about myself first. I'm not going to lose sleep over somebody else's problems." Like, he took no responsibility for this. So, like, he didn't do it, but he's clearly a sociopath as well.
Either that or he's in such insanely deep denial, because it's, yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense.
It's like, that's like saying, it's not my problem, where it's like, you just, it's 100% your problem. Yeah, there's like, no, you can't just deny your way out of it.
And "I fucked up" goes so far, you know?
Yeah, but that's like,
"I should have done something, I'm sorry" goes so far.
But that's not who you're dealing with.
I know, I know. And then, listen to this shit. This is the craziest shit to me. So his parents were his adoptive parents. They adopted him as an infant.
This is Cash or Jerry?
No, this is Strohmeyer, the killer.
Yeah.
In 1999, they sued Los Angeles County and its adoption workers for $1 million, claiming that the social workers deliberately withheld crucial information that would have stopped them from adopting him as an infant. Specifically, they claimed that they were never told that Strohmeyer's biological mother had severe mental problems, including that she suffered from chronic schizophrenia and had been hospitalized more than 60 times prior to Strohmeyer's birth.
Shit.
However, they state that they continue to support their adopted son.
So basically they were like, he's not ours anymore. In the most, like, indirect way.
Like, they were basically like, this isn't what we asked for.
Except for, it was totally fine up until that point.
Yeah. If he hadn't had any wins, they would have been like, it's because we raised him right.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't want to talk shit on adoption because I think it's fucking amazing and I would totally do it. And like, but this is your kid. You can't sue the fucking city for $1 million because something went wrong when he was fucking 17.
Well, also, 18. I would love to know, like, what kind of, like, tax bracket of people we're talking about.
Yeah.
Because it's like, everybody's running to talk about how it's not their problem, it's not their fault, it's not their problem, it's not their fault. It's like, sorry, you guys are ground zero.
Yeah.
You touched his fucking head. You saw him raping a child. Nobody, it's 100% your problem.
Nobody wants to take any responsibility for any part of this.
It's crazy.
And it's so frustrating. Like, remorse is something that we can all connect with.
Mm-hmm.
Remorse is something we can all, like, understand and feel. Even if it's shit that we would never do, it's like, I fucked up. I was, you know, thinking wrong. I was crazy. It wasn't right. And, like, yeah, that doesn't get you out of punishment, but it goes so far for so many things.
Yeah, but you're talking about, you expect something from people who are fucking child rapists and killers. These aren't noble, yeah, moral people in any way.
Well, think of the kind of parents that would sue the city because their son was a murderer. Like, those
fucking
people,
17 years too late.
You couldn't have raised your kid right if that's your first fucking instinct.
Yeah. No, it's no good. I totally remember that story.
Yeah.
And I'm really glad that you didn't talk about details, because I feel like there was a time where I knew the details,
yeah,
of what he did to her, and I am glad I can't remember it right now.
I remember the news. I remember seeing the surveillance footage, yep, on the news.
Me too.
I just want to, like, talk about this girl and how awful it was for her, and, like, it's just so, like, the person at the fucking center of this, while these people are fucking getting their appeals and suing the city and saying that, like, they walked away because they couldn't deal with what was happening.
Yeah.
And, you know, none of it is fair to this fucking kid who,
well, and also,
didn't understand.
That father, that's a hugely problematic family. Yeah. Anybody that's up at 4 a.m. at a casino, they didn't, so why doesn't that guy have a room or a car that those kids can be in? Like, it doesn't make sense.
Why are you taking your kid to Vegas to begin with?
But yeah, and then also 4 a.m, yeah. No child should be awake. No. Like there should be a system in place where if you work at a casino and it's past 2 a.m. yeah. And you see anyone that looks younger than 18, we need driver's licenses, we need yeah. action to be taken.
Well, the end of it is that there's a Charisse Iverson bill introduced after this that provides a fine and possibly jail time for anyone who fails to report a crime of the nature that led to the creation of the bill. So, like, unless, like, if someone dies and you don't tell on them, basically, you could get fined, which is like, fuck you. And then there's increased security in Nevada casinos. And also, they've increased security in their arcades and casinos, which is like, well, your security guards could be fucking perverts, so that doesn't really do anything. Don't trust anyone.
Yeah, I mean, you got to tighten up your game. There's kids in casinos do not mix. I don't care what Circus has told you.
My dad took us to Circus as a kid and was like, go play fucking video games.
That's what it's built for. Meanwhile, what the fuck? Like, there's nothing about that that makes sense.
In the thing we talk about a lot, which is like, I should have been killed mode.
Yeah.
I should have been kidnapped. I mean, I was a really cute kid, but like.
You were pretty precious. I've seen pictures.
Pretty darling. I should have been kidnapped and killed.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And I would have been if I was like, we had kittens in the van. I'd be like, fucking kitten. Even now, I'd be like, kitten?
Maybe next week should be, that could have been me.
Yeah. That's the one I wanted to do today. And I was like, I'm so excited. I got my 90s murder. And I was like, 1985. God damn it.
Let's do that next week.
Okay. Next week is like, this should have been me.
This could have been me.
This could have been me.
Or should have, or whatever.
Should have been.
Yeah.
This will be. No.
This.
God, no.
When I write my autobiography and lie, it's going to be me.
This totally almost could have maybe happened to me. Oh, I have Glennis's story, but we've gone so long now. I feel like
Should we save it for next week?
Let's have a memorial real quick.
Yeah. So somebody wrote on the Facebook page very earnestly, which I understand. The day that Michelle McNamara died, they posted a thing, kind of saying, "Karen or Georgia, you need to do a special episode about Michelle McNamara," and I understand where that was coming from. But I guess the thing I need that person to understand and everybody to understand is Michelle was a real person that I knew. And she was a friend. I've been friends with her husband for almost 30 years. It's not, the kind of thing that's very easy to turn around and be, and podcast about as if it's some piece of news. It's, for me, it is a personal loss. I mean, in the way that I have a friend who is now a widower with a 7-year-old child, it's such a massive tragedy. And Michelle was such a brilliant woman. She was such a talented writer. She was so into everything that we're all into, and she made such great content. She was an author. She wrote these really cool articles. You can find her old blog was called True Crime Diary, which we've talked about on the podcast before, but she also, it's very easy to find the article she wrote about, the Golden State Killer, which was her terminology that she renamed the East Area Rapist and the original Night Stalker, the Golden State Killer, and she was writing a book on it. And it's such a massive loss, and it's such a real thing that's happening in our lives, that it's not something that we can just kind of turn around and present as if it's something distant, because it's not. So, I loved Michelle and I love Patton, and it's just a incomprehensible, tragedy that is the kind of shit you just never want to happen, and that happens. So hug the people that you love, tell the people that you love them, live the life that you want to live, and just be cool to people, I guess, is what I would say.
That was beautiful. That sounded...
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Tales of Mystery, followed by the CBS Radio Mystery Theater at 2.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 81 and clear. Mostly cloudy tonight with a low in the upper 70s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the low 90s. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy with a low in the low 80s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas.
This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by the Georgia Radio Reading Service, GARS. Hello, this is Mark Bergeson presenting Mystery Story Hour. We are reading today from the July and August 2020 edition of Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine. Our story today is entitled Plein Air, written by Elaine Menga. James pulled off his knit cap and slung his jacket over the back of a chair. He swiped his hand across the table and sent sugar granules flying. The coffee cup was less crowded today. If Mia came in, she couldn't miss him. If she shared his table as she had a week ago, they could talk without having to raise their voices. The acoustics in this place were crap. It was her favorite caffeine bar, not his. He could hear two women two tables away loud and clear. They were deep into a crime show about stalkers. Then came gossip about a friend who'd suffered that fate with a guy she had dated. When she nixed a second date, the creep began spying. "I caught that cockroach in the act," said the redhead whose broad back faced James. "You did? You saw him?" Her partner's brows hiked to her hairline. "On Gina's porch, peeping through the blinds. I'm coming up the walk." He turns, takes one look, and jumps off the porch over her granddaddy azalea bushes. What a face! Pocked with acne scars. Made my skin crawl. "Oh, God, he didn't hurt Gina, did he?" "No, there's different kinds of stalkers, you know. Some are dangerous, of course, but most are just these pathetic guys. They scope out a woman, try to make a connection, but they're shy, real losers. Nothing comes of it." "Hey, I think I've been the victim of that last kind." The redhead laughed herself silly. James wished these two had an off switch. Yes, he'd staked out Mia's coffee shop and her shotgun double in the River Bend part of New Orleans. But he wasn't a stalker, just one of her students. He bowed his head and concentrated on his laptop, some art blog Mia had recommended. Anything to distract him from the babble of these two. He guessed Mia wasn't going to show. In 20 minutes, he had to head back to the bank anyway. Little tangible wealth of his own was deposited there. He was a junior loan officer, and the job bored him witless. Why he'd ever gone into finance was a question that often tormented him. Then again, whatever he went into didn't matter much, because he really wanted to be an artist. No money there, anyone could tell you. He eyed his watch, ultimate dictator of where he must be and when. Then he heard Mia's musical voice and felt the touch of her hand on his shoulder. "James, hello." He glanced up. A nimbus of cold air still enveloped her. Her eyes, deep and dark, set wide apart, conveyed their singular interest in him. She pulled off her fuzzy earmuffs and smoothed her short black hair. Arthur Volinsky was with her, the resident plein air artist of the Crescent City School of Fine Arts. "My most talented student," Mia directed the words to Arthur. "Last Saturday, the last day of class, I told him, 'James, you are a green field.'" James remembered. The words meant so much. But her gaze was bestowed on Volinsky, as if he were the object of her praise. "He really is," she said with emphasis. "A green field." And now, the second week in December, the term is over, James thought. Over. When would he see Mia again? Volinsky winked. "Don't get too excited. She says that to all the guys." James noted specks of blue paint riding the bushy hairs of his right eyebrow. "Only the good-looking ones? Look at this face." Mia opened her palm inches from James' chin. "Classic. Have you ever seen such a sensitive mouth? Like a Russian prince." Volinsky nodded. "Too bad we aren't portrait painters." "Speak for yourself." Mia jabbed a thumb Volinsky's way. "This guy only paints the effects of light on derelict buildings."
"While you slap together esoteric images stripping with deep, meaningless meaning." "Hey, don't blame me. Those words are taken verbatim from your latest artist statement."
James gazed at them as if watching a rally in a tennis match. So this guy could talk, even in complex sentences. Art Volinsky had a reputation for being nearly mute during his classes. Maybe unintelligible was the more precise word.
"Whatever," Mia resumed. "I believe James leans toward being a cognitive artist, like me. He's a marvelous draftsman, too."
"Give him a chance," Volinsky said. "He might get plein air in his veins. Consider it, James, next time around."
"Let's not get into that argument again."
Mia popped a pretend punch against his upper arm. Gazing down at James, she added,
"Good to see you."
James nodded agreement. Better to be a man, a few words. They moved on to a table that hugged the rear wall. James pretended to scan his laptop a while longer. The two women were still discussing pathetic men. When he stood up, his feet felt strangely leaden. He pushed the door open. A blast of cold air pushed back. A wet oak leaf slapped his cheek. It was a slow afternoon. James shuffled papers, pretending to be busy. Warm air blew down on his head from a whiny ceiling vent. On a memo pad, he doodled a caricature of his boss, the pompous guy whose glass-walled office faced his own, much smaller, transparent cubicle. Between them lay an atrium garden, bordered by twin brick walkways leading to the teller's counters at the rear. Amid the greenery, a bamboo pole languidly seesawed, one end filling with water, reaching its tipping point, then relieving itself on the other end with a polite gurgle. As he doodled, his thoughts returned to Mia and Volinsky. On a Saturday morning weeks earlier, Mia had taken James' beginning drawing class on an outing to see Volinsky's studio. It occupied an ancient, white-clappered cottage situated 100 feet from the elegant, repurposed Greek Revival home that housed the Crescent City School of Fine Arts. It had been a cold day, full of roving thunderstorms.
Volensky's plein air class, which by definition always meant outdoors, was hunkered inside, employing the technique on still lifes. Volensky appeared unaware of Mia's intrusion. One hand on hip, he gestured with the other at a canvas set before a 20-something female student. Turpentine and linseed oil fumes hung heavy in the air. Two space heaters gave off an orange glow, but they were no match for the cottage's non-existent insulation. Mia cleared her throat.
As you know, the Crescent's emphasis is on studio art, much like the classical training you would have received in 18th and 19th century Europe.
She glanced Volensky's way.
Arthur, you don't mind our invasion, do you? It seemed a good time, considering the monsoons.
Turning back to her students, she added,
We do this every semester, a mutual exchange.
Volensky was still talking to his student, who, James noticed, was way on the plus side of merely pretty. Gazing into her teacher's face, the girl jabbed her brush in Mia's direction. Volensky woke up to his guests.
Oh, welcome all, he said, eyes blinking.
He spread his arms out wide and bowed like a Shakespearean actor. Mia's dimples creased her cheeks, showing off her smile that James loved to see. Hers were strong, deep laugh lines, not just cute baby quotation marks.
As I was saying, Mia continued, although our concentration is studio art, the venerable, locally famous Arthur Volensky has won a niche in our lofty curriculum. His plein air instruction is, well, more relaxed, slightly bohemian.
The higher ups exiled me to this blasted outpost. Beware the rotting floorboards and the occasional behemoth roach, though they're hibernating just now.
He pulled off a muffler from around his scruffy neck, then rewound it higher.
Another balmy day in paradise.
Art, you look chilled to the bone, Mia said.
You got here just in time to witness the death of a starving artist in a first-floor garret, no less. Or should I say artists?
He gestured at his shivering plein-air students.
Oh, such drama! Mia nodded to Volensky. We have it so cozy in the main building. Life isn't fair, but don't weep for Arthur. The higher-ups are about to bulldoze this place and build a state-of-the-art addition. He'll get a brand spanking new studio with central air, though he'd rather brave the elements, right?
Volensky's left eyebrow ticked up.
So, here's the historical context.
Mia described the origins of plein air. Painting outdoors, the emphasis on open air that became the focus of French Impressionism.
As opposed to the artificial method of studio art, Volensky put in. Not that I'd want a student to dismiss any creative impulse on its face.
Mia raised her brows in clear disagreement.
In any case, leaning against these walls are Mr. Volensky's most recent works, due for an exhibition in early spring. Right, Arthur?
Well, who knows?
Here at the Crescent Gallery?
He smiled.
I might have some other irons in the fire.
You heard it here first. The entire world of art galleries is beating a path to Arthur Volensky's door.
Her students produced a few tentative laughs. Volensky executed a ho-hum lift of his shoulders and turned back to his pretty student. His studio was a mess. Trash cans full of paint-soaked rags, paper towels, soda, and beer cans looked as if they hadn't been emptied in years. But the paintings leaning against the walls told another story. James did a slow 360 turn, taking them in.
As if Mia had caught the look of awe on James' face, she said, "It is an impressive body of work. Arthur will destroy half and keep only the best for his show. For this kind of spontaneous approach for what he's trying to achieve, he's very good." The bank's heating system clicked off, and James woke up from his reverie. Even now, looking back, he sensed there had been something off about Mia's praise. He assessed the caricature he'd drawn of his boss. Too flattering. He closed his eyes, remembering Valensky's studio vividly. Before leaving the Crescent that day, he'd gone back a second time to see the paintings. The door was unlocked, the big room empty of people and egos. Dabs of oil-based pigment on canvas revealed what the light at any particular moment was doing. A gray stucco wall in full sun here, a porch railing in shade there. The paintings were impressionistic, but at the same time fiercely real. Atomic level real, beating with life and the suggestion that everything could change in a blink. New Orleans street scenes, uptown and downtown. Cars sagging in front of a craftsman bungalow from the 1920s. Lions guarding front steps. Oak tree roots breaking up sidewalks. Crepe myrtles naked or in full bloom. Power lines, crooked signs. Not a whiff of sentimentality. Just good, old-fashioned reality of the moment, whether gritty or pretty or grittily grand. Two more banking hours to go. He wished he could talk to someone, even have a silly conversation, as he used to with Kay, his last girlfriend. It was Kay who had suggested he take a class at the Crescent in the first place. "It might be just the thing for you," she said. "My aunt takes classes there. Loves the place. It's like a college with only art instruction on the menu." "Your aunt?" He made a face. "Don't think I want to join a dabbler society for retirees." "You can be such a jerk, James. Sure, some students are older, and there's some uptown society types with time on their hands. But there's also a younger bunch who want a grounding in the classical approach the school promotes. Check out the website." Funny how Kay had found the very thing that would break them up. With a sigh, he crumpled a doodle and flipped a perfect shot into his wastebasket. After work, he drove his dented blue Civic to Mia's place on Plum Street. He glided past as if he were on the way to a worthier destination. The second time around, he still couldn't bring himself to glance at the front door. If she emerged and saw him, she'd know that he was watching, and she'd be afraid. Her skin might even crawl, as that redhead at the coffee cup put it. But then the memory of the redhead's broad, flabby back and scratchy voice brought on a surprising bout of laughter. The last thing that woman would ever have to worry about was any guy driving past her front door, as he was driving past Mia's now, heart beating like a bongo drum on steroids. Laughing calmed him until the next drive-by. This time he saw Mia jump off the back of Valensky's Honda motorcycle. They shared a kiss that lasted several beats longer than what might be called brief. James took that in as if it were a neutral fact. But on the trip home, his breaths came fast, and his grip on the wheel could crumble kryptonite. How could she kiss that shaggy beast? Valensky's beard was as coarse as an Irish wolfhound's, and he was so lame. Just a week ago, after James' last class with Mia, he saw that Valensky's students had set up shop a block down from the art school. James strolled over to see. As his acolytes were painting away, Valensky threw his hands up, ecstatic. "This moment, feel it, mellow yellow, like Donovan. That old song, Electrical Banana. he sang. Volensky was only vaguely present with his class. His eyes said he was over the rainbow, the thoughts escaping his brain. So many untethered orphans floating in the ether, or, more precisely, the plein air he was always talking about. Yet some women liked that type, namely Mia. In mid-January, a new term started. James signed up for Volensky's plein air. If he took Mia's drawing class over and over, it might look odd. Besides, now that he'd learned more about plein air, he had to admit the technique interested him. Volensky's students met outside at one location or another. He demonstrated his method. No lectures. His motto? Learn by doing. Dabs of paint decorated his khaki pants and tunic shirts, not to mention his face and hair, much in the style of an earlier human canvas, Vincent van Gogh. The idea was to paint fast, capture the light in the moment. "Good start," Volensky told James the second Saturday. He bounced down to a squat beside him. "After 100 paintings, you'll make serious headway in this conversation you're having with your subject. Don't ever make it an object, something dead. Always remember..." He sprang up to his full height and raised his ropey arms to the sky. "It's alive! It's alive!"
"That's his Dr. Frankenstein impersonation," a blue-haired woman at the next easel deadpanned. "He does that a lot, but he's good."
Volensky was good, his eyes sharp as a crow's, as James' granddad would say. But how James missed Mia. He'd seen her a few times in the main building's broad hall. As always, she wore a scoop-neck tee that showed off her elegant neck and collarbones. She granted him a breezy wave, her dimples showing to maximum effect. It was his ex-girlfriend, Kay, who made him realize how much Mia's neck and collarbones turned him on. When he told her he needed some space, Kay said,
"It's that drawing teacher, isn't it? I saw her in the Times-Picayune's art section, post-debutante with the neck and collarbones a ballerina would die for. Knows just how to show them off, too. The pixie haircut helps. But with those wide-set eyes, can't help noting she looks more than a little bit like a Martian."
Head tilted, mouth slightly ajar, James said, "That's a rotten thing to say."
"True, like meow. But what is she? 10 years your senior? And that's the least of it."
"No, it's 7, but the least of it."
"The type. So, okay, we're over, but figure it out. Your attraction to the type. And if you don't get my meaning, then just... good luck, James."
Once James started plein air, he still hung out at the coffee cup when possible, and passed by Mia's house, but she didn't come for coffee. On Plum Street, he saw her only fleetingly, and then he decided never to go there again. Kay's good luck, which really meant "you poor doomed bastard," made him stop and consider what he was doing. One foggy night, the first Tuesday in February, though, nearing midnight, he couldn't sleep. He drove to Mia's. Why? Merely to see if the light was still on? Third window down, fronting the alley that ran along her half of the double? He guessed that one marked her bedroom. He parked on the other side of the street beneath a crepe myrtle. When he craned to the left, he had a clear view. The window was dark, though the alley and quaid fence it fronted was lit by a spotlight mounted below the eaves of the neighboring house. Light pollution, he thought,
in a free-floating state of mind. But it was kind of nice how the yellowish light shone on the morning glory vine that snaked along the fence. Mia had mentioned her morning glories in class, how a freeze in December had shriveled the vine. But it would come back, she said. She was always upbeat in a sophisticated, muted way. I will paint that alley some day, James said to his side window, his breath fogging the glass, eyes nearly shut. Like an unfocused camera, he lazily panned right and stared straight ahead at the car he had parked behind, one of those two cute Fiats, mint green. It took a while for him to process what he was seeing through the Fiat's back window and straight through its front windshield. The offending vision was not of another car parked in front of the Fiat, but the glint chrome handlebars of a motorcycle. He groaned as if someone had taken a crowbar to his ribs and pried them north, south, east, and west. His passion for Mia had fueled him, driven him for months. It had depth and power. But it was all for nothing. A figure emerged from the black maw of Mia's front door. The dim porch light revealed Arthur Volinsky. He pulled the door closed. Shoulders hunched, he shoved a key into the deadbolt to lock it. Straightening, he patted his hands against his leather jacket, a jacket so worn that his students made fun of the thing as it looked no thicker than an old grocery bag. The hand patting continued until a pack of cigarettes in his right chest pocket agreed to be discovered. He poked a white stick between his skinny lips and padded further for the lighter. The guy was so unorganized, he didn't even know which pocket he'd filed his cigarettes and lighter in. How could Mia be involved with this kook who looked one step from being a homeless person? A smoker, too. Something about Volinsky's talent must have reeled her in against her better judgment. What was it? His aura of detachment? Was that a desirable trait? Damn, she'd given him the key to her house. James couldn't believe it. Now fully awake, he scrunched down behind the wheel as Volinsky scuffed toward his cycle in the boots he always wore. The back edges of their heels, James noted more than once, were completely eroded, as if he habitually performed Irish jigs on rough concrete. The engine emitted a loud burp, followed by even cruder aftershocks. When the noise became a distant gurgle, James surfaced. His blood was up. He thought he could defeat this idiot savant in an eye blink if he wanted to, but a simple fact knocked all the vinegar out of him. Mia had given Volinsky the key, the same as bestowing upon him the key to her heart. After that night, James had no desire to attend his plein air class. He missed the following Saturday. He needed to put this sad episode behind him. From now on, he vowed, whenever he felt ready to cave in, rather than hanging out at the coffee shop or driving past Mia's, he would walk the loop in Audubon Park, no matter what. The very next Monday, he parked on St. Charles Avenue after work and walked the broad asphalt track that meandered alongside the park's lagoons and giant oaks. His thoughts strayed to Mia. Where was she now? Leaving the Crescent? On the way home to meet Volinsky later. He hugged the loop's outermost edge, heading counterclockwise, and forced himself to look at the trees, breathe in the moss-filtered air. He made an effort to see something else, anything to get free of his obsessive thoughts. He needed perspective. Damn how he needed it. Perhaps he would call Kay, tell her that he wanted to try again. Just then his head jerked up. His name had been called. He